Hello, listeners. Welcome to the Medical Care Blog's official podcast. I'm Greg Stevens, co-editor of the Medical Care Blog. On today's podcast, I'll look at the posts from December, share a conversation on homelessness with Dr. Ben King, and preview the January issue of Medical Care. But first, the end of 2021 marked several big milestones for our blog. First, we finished our sixth full year of blogging at our current site in partnership with the journal Medical Care. Second, the fantastic December post that I'm about to review helped us reach our highest monthly readership in any month since we started. And because of that, we ended the year for the first time with well over 50,000 reads. We, of course, couldn't do this without our tremendous contributors and without all of you who have been regularly following us, reading, sharing, and critiquing our work. We truly appreciate it. To give you a taste of what propelled us through December, here's a quick recap of the posts that we released last month. Just before the holiday, Jack Westfall, the director of the Robert Graham Center for Policy Studies and a regular contributor to our blog, wrote an impassioned piece about using Medicaid to carve in mental health services. Dr. Westfall explained that in many states that rely on managed care to deliver Medicaid, mental health services are often carved out. This means another organization is paid to deliver the mental health services, separate from the physical health ones. He explained that this creates inadequate networks of mental health providers, and instead, Medicaid should be contracting directly with any and all mental health providers, including primary care providers, to create a no-wrong-door approach to mental health services. Earlier in the month, Alexa Ortiz, a health IT scientist and nurse from RTI, and another one of our favorite contributors to the blog, wrote a synopsis of her attendance at the All-In National Meeting, which is a learning network of U.S.-based community collaborators working to develop shared data systems on social determinants of health. She described the meeting as showcasing the power of community data, and her piece introduced me to the phrase decolonized data, which I understood to refer to the lack of community ownership of the data that researchers and officials collect. She highlights a number of initiatives around the country to address this and develop, collect, and share data on social determinants of health using community involvement and leadership. She reminds us that you can't improve what you don't measure. Catherine Foster, a public health analyst at RTI, wrote her second piece for our blog and provided an excellent summary of the literature on what we know about how nursing homes did in managing COVID-19. She explains how research on nursing homes and COVID-19 evolved over the pandemic, in part changing from a focus on cases to mortality rates as the data became increasingly available. Making sense of a boggling number of studies on the issue, she explained that the two main determinants of COVID-19 cases and deaths are the larger number of beds in nursing homes and the location of the nursing homes in areas with a higher concentration of cases. She suggests that metrics of quality of the nursing homes, like those from CMS's Care Compare, are not consistently related to COVID-19 outcomes, with a number of those studies reporting mixed results. Rounding out our month, RTI researchers Amy Chapatis and Amaryllis Bernicette wrote a detailed summary of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Financial Alignment Initiative. It's a mouthful, but this initiative funded 13 demonstration projects that aimed to improve care for dually eligible individuals, those with Medicare and Medicaid, by identifying social risk factors and then aiming to meet their social needs. They described two unique demonstration projects in Washington and in Minnesota in quite some detail, and then classified how those 13 demonstrations overall are attempting to address social needs. They also link to a helpful issue brief that they prepared for CMS. And if you're curious about this financial alignment initiative, this blog post is a really great starting point. All right, next up on the podcast, I want to share a conversation that I had with Dr. Ben King. He is a regular contributor to the Medical Care blog. He's also a researcher involved deeply in healthcare for homeless individuals and for vulnerable populations in general. We cover a number of topics, including his publishing on the blog, a special issue on homelessness with the Veterans Administration, published at the Medical Care Journal, and what's next for measuring homelessness and mortality. So I've got Dr. Ben King on the line with me, and I feel very lucky to have a conversation with him because we share an interest in homelessness and healthcare related to caring for people who are homeless or experiencing homelessness. So hi, Dr. King, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Hi, thank you.
Good. Well, maybe I can start just by asking you how you got interested in the topic of homelessness.
Oh man, it's not a short story, unfortunately. But I guess the shorter version is that when I came to study public health, I left a early career in inpatient psychiatric care. Which was a real disaster, and came to public health to try and understand how to improve the systems. I'd kind of stumbled onto the issue. I thought I was going to work in global health. In fact, I was on track to be sent to Uganda with MSF actually at the end of my program, and I found a free clinic here in Houston, actually, Houston, Texas, where they were doing a form of street medicine, of street outreach and student-run free care in a clinic setting, and really saw a lot of what I thought I was going to be doing in other countries, that global health was happening on the streets, sort of right under our noses, and realized just saw the disparities in a way I hadn't seen even in psychiatry or facilities so starkly. It kind of woke me up a little bit, and I really never looked back. I got really sort of obsessed. Once you look under that space that most people don't want to look at in community or in healthcare.
You've written a ton for the Medical Care blog,
I
and
love that blog.
it's all been really good stuff. And I've written a little bit about homelessness for the Medical Care blog. Maybe we could just have a bit of a conversation about some of the things we wrote, and also maybe I could get you to talk a little bit about what the future of healthcare for homeless people is. Maybe I could get you to talk a little bit about, and they've been interested in the mortality count. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. But first, maybe you want to tell us a little bit about some of the things you've written for the Medical Care blog. Do you, you had a special issue with the Veterans Administration.
Most recently, it was a blog post about the special issue of the journal Medical Care, which I was really thrilled to get the opportunity to co-edit with Jack Tsai and Jen Elder. Jack Tsai with the BA and of course a regional dean for the UT School of Public Health, now formerly at Yale, and Jen Elder, who's a contractor, head of PRA and SAMHSA's new homelessness research center. So yeah, two real experts, and then little old me guest editing. A special issue, and it was a remarkable experience, although boy, it was overwhelming because of the timing. We closed submissions in March of 2020, which nothing else in public health was going on at that time. And I understand, I mean, you just wrote one even more recently, I think, right?
Well, yeah, I did. I
for
did.
the
And
Post.
I was really,
Talk
happy.
about innovations too. That's one of the most exciting things in housing right now going on. Do you mind? I know this is your podcast, but can you tell the listeners about tiny homes and what you guys wrote
Yeah,
about?
for sure. For sure. So I live in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles struggles with homelessness. I feel like unlike any other city. That's probably not quite true, but I know it's a big issue for our city. And I happen to live in one community that struggles mightily with homelessness, in part because of a lot of gentrification happening in this part of town. This is the east side of Los Angeles. And one day along our major 110 freeway that travels from sort of North LA to downtown, we noticed a bunch of little homes, little kind of like the sheds being built. And so a neighbor and I, this neighbor, Tom Fassbender, he's a founder of the Los Angeles Explorers Guild, which means he likes to go out and check out everything that's interesting and happening in LA. So the two of us went and popped in to that what was being built there. And it turns out the next night they were having an open house. And so what it was is essentially a little tiny home village being built for people experiencing homelessness right here in the community. So there was a lot of a lot of cheering, of course, for the building of these little homes because it was essentially taking encampment in that same area and giving them some real shelter. But then there was a lot of pushback, the community members starting these change.org kinds of things to basically protest, because what they thought is it was going to draw more homeless people from across Los Angeles. But what so what we did in exploring this and what we wrote about on the blog is that there was these tiny home villages were essentially built to serve people right there in that community. So they essentially only canvassed within a 3 mile radius of that that tiny village, tiny home village. Yeah, so kind of, ultimately there may be people that would be attracted to the area, but Los Angeles is exploding with these tiny home villages. And it's really kind of an amazing thing. I'd be curious to know what you think.
I'm not familiar with anything here, but it's become a very popular model, and we have a large organization in Austin that has been building a large tiny home community. It sort of sounds awkward. A large area of tiny homes on the north east side of town, just on the edge of the bus routes, essentially, where you can actually afford, I'm sure LA is the same way, where you can actually afford a little real estate. And they've been putting hundreds of people together actually into a single community and creating a lot of occupational sort of opportunities and putting services on site and all kinds of things. To really round out what was originally very nerve-wracking, of course. You have a little bit of concern. This is just concentrating people without really providing the wraparound services. That was my initial reaction and several other people's in the community. But when you start to see people putting thought and care into supporting the effort to build a community like that and to create housing, even if it's not the ideal type of housing, and it's not, the traditional method of vouchers and scattered site, placements and all those things. This is a new approach, and I think we have a lot to learn from it. We have a lot, I think, that will evolve out of it as well. But especially if you can get the community to really buy in and create those wraparound services to support the people who are moving in to those facilities, it's a lot better than where they were before. And I've seen some remarkable stories. In fact, the one in Austin now has a drive up or it's an outdoor movie theater where they do screenings and you can buy food, and all of the positions are, staffed by people who live in that community. There's, shops and all kinds of skills training, and crafts and all kinds of things in the community. So it's quite a beautiful space, actually, and I'm a big fan.
So in the next few weeks, I believe there's the homeless count is going to begin again. I
Yeah,
know
the
it's
point
happening.
in time count. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's happening here in Los Angeles. It's happening in major cities across the country. But you mentioned to me at some point that there's a change in there's an effort underway to be more accurate in the counting of mortality tied to people who are experiencing homelessness. Do you want to tell us about that?
There's another movement that I think is really important, and I hesitate to say exciting. We talk about these dark things, and sometimes I can sound glib, but of course, it's a devastating reality that there's excess mortality. This is a condition. It's an experience or an exposure that kills people. It's why we need to understand it better, and we've been, I think, as a country and as certain communities in particular, really focusing on that issue. What is it that's killing people? How, to what degree? Understanding what is the excess mortality for people in this experience, having this experience pushed into this position. And it's really been led, of course, by a couple of big cities, and a couple of pioneers in smaller ones too. There's under the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council, they've been convening not all, but a lot of the big names from different cities who conduct or attempt to, enumerate the number of individuals experiencing homelessness that die each year. I think the gold standard to me is still LA County, actually. But every community really has the opportunity to take on a mortality count, and that's what we're encouraging people to do. The council just published a mortality count toolkit that we had. We want people to take on at least some level of effort in trying to enumerate. Of course, in December we have the Memorial Day for people experiencing homelessness, right around Veterans Day, that tends to, be acknowledged, and then we move on. But it's a really important thing, I think, that communities do to try and have some closure around the loss that occurs year round in this community.
Dr. King, thank you. Ben, thank you for your time. This was a really great conversation. I hope we can do this again.
I love to. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about it and the shared passion. It's just something we have to talk about. That's what it comes down to. So I appreciate it, and thank you to all the listeners.
And now a quick preview of some of the articles published in the January issue of the journal Medical Care. There were a lot of great articles in this issue, but I want to point out three. There's an article by Ann Schuster and colleagues that looked at the effect of the Affordable Care Act on women's postpartum insurance coverage, and they did this in states that didn't expand Medicaid. This study found that after the ACA went into effect, women were more likely to maintain insurance coverage postpartum and may have experienced fewer depressive symptoms. By focusing on states that did not expand Medicaid, they were able to determine that it was the components of the ACA, like the insurance exchanges and subsidies, that probably helped the women, rather than simply the expansion of Medicaid. Another article by Minglang Dai and colleagues studied the effects of CMS's Transforming Clinical Practice Initiative. The authors looked at over 700 family medicine practices nationally that participated in the initiative, and they compared them to nearly 3,500 family medicine practices that did not participate. They compared them on Medicare costs, hospital admissions, and emergency department visit rates. Interestingly, the study found that the intervention and comparison practices were nearly indistinguishable on these outcomes, suggesting that the initiative has not been that successful, or perhaps that it takes longer than just a few years for the practice changes to pay off. Finally, a study by Abubakar Sadiq Abdulwali and colleagues found that emergency department wait times from 2003 to 2017 have actually decreased across the United States. The median wait time at an ED was under 20 minutes by 2017. Now, this could have changed, of course, with the arrival of the pandemic, but pre-pandemic, this positive trend was accompanied by data showing that disparities in ED waiting times experienced by Black and Hispanic individuals actually declined over the period as well, and had mostly disappeared by 2017. So some good news there. You know, there really are a number of interesting articles in the January issue, with more on methods for conducting feasibility analyses and pilot studies, a study on the impact of Medicare insurance coverage on lung cancer screening rates, a comparison of home health care costs and utilization among Medicare enrollees in Medicare Advantage versus traditional Medicare. So many good things. Be sure to head over to the journal's website to check out those articles. A quick thank you again to all of you for listening, and a special thank you to Ben King for joining me today. Tune in next month for another episode of the Medical Care Blog Podcast.